Welcome to the Young Turks, everybody. It's Thursday. Cenk, you're still gone. John Arola, Anna Kasparian joining me.
Hi.
Today is going to be a bit of a grab bag. We had to go searching for stuff to cover. No big story to get to.
It's been a really slow news day. I don't know.
It has. It has. Goddamn Britain messing things up. We had a nice rundown planned out. We got the Comey stuff, obviously. But then we were going to talk about the tax reform coming to Kansas that is years in the making. We're going to talk about the possible reauthorization of one of the foreign surveillance components of FISA. We had Dodd-Frank, and we're still going to get to as much of that as we can. But then the Brits had to go and vote. God damn it. Okay, so we're going to be talking about that too after we come back from our first break.
Yeah.
But lots to get to, so unless there's anything?
The one thing I wanted to kind of notify you guys about is that in hour two, I will be joined by Grace. And at the top of the rundown, we will discuss the Senate's version of the replacement for Obamacare. So there will be a lot of policy discussion on the show today, in addition to coverage of Comey's testimony.
Mm-hmm. Well, then why don't we jump into it?
Let's do it.
Okay. Obviously, today was dominated by the news of James Comey's testimony, the open testimony, with many senators getting in questions. There was also a closed private testimony after that, which we might never know what was revealed there. But we're going to break down some of the different things that Comey revealed, because although we had his written testimony yesterday, the questions were much more revelatory, his answers to those questions. And one thing that I wanted to focus on here is the interactions between Donald Trump and James Comey and Comey's descriptions of them, but also the attempts by Republicans to sort of use selectively the language of James Comey to misinterpret, mischaracterize what Comey is saying. So here, first of all, is the word hope, how we interpret the word hope.
I don't know well enough to answer. And the reason I keep saying his words is I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the President of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do. Now, I didn't obey that, but that's the way I took it.
So look, Risch there is a Republican senator, and he's saying Trump just said he hopes you can make this Flynn thing disappear. And Trump had used that sort of language multiple times in regard to the investigation and his attempts to try to get the FBI to stop it. And so Republicans, including Risch, but also surrogates on TV, have jumped on that and are trying to say that the president clearing a room, telling the attorney general to leave, the vice president, Kushner even, to leave, and then telling the head of the FBI that he hopes he can make it disappear, doesn't have any connotation beyond the mere words. Obviously, to Comey, that's laughable, but a lot of Republicans believe that that is an out for them.
Right. So I think that obviously every word is up for interpretation. And people will look at the same conversation and have different interpretations of what the president meant. But for me, what's important to keep in mind is that there is a power imbalance. You have, yes, the FBI director who is in a position of power, but then you also have the president of the United States who is essentially the most powerful person, not only in this country, but in the world. And so even though the word hope is not definitive and it's not the same as saying you need to drop the investigation, it still implies something, at least especially for Comey, that essentially kind of pushes an individual to
like
drop.
Like a mafia boss would have done it or
right.
something
I
like
mean,
that. Yeah.
Look, I don't know if this lives up to any type of burden of proof necessary to prove that Donald Trump is obstructing justice. There might be a higher standard there, right? But I do think that it is, in the very least, an incredibly inappropriate conversation to have with the FBI director.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the one thing that sort of works in Donald Trump's defense here is he tells Comey, I hope you can make this disappear. Mm-hmm. Comey doesn't make it disappear, and Comey remains head of the FBI today because he just hoped. There were no consequences.
Right.
Oh, no, he fired him. He fired him. It wasn't just hope, you fools, you morons, God. But there are people being paid by CNN right now as we speak to sit on panels and try to explain away everything that Comey did because Comey told Trump that he wasn't under investigation and used the word hope. That is not the out that they think it is. And as we continue to break down, or as Comey broke down today, all the various ways that Trump tried to stop the investigation, tried to put pressure on him, whether the other heads of the various intel organizations would use the word pressure or not. If you're a Republican and you still don't think that Trump has done anything wrong, or if you're if you're a blind lib with your head in the sand, who would go to all this trouble to continually clear the room, to try to put pressure on people like Comey, to do all of this to hide nothing? If there was nothing there, why would there be a multi-month campaign that Trump seemed to understand was likely illegal? That's why he kept trying to do it behind closed doors in private with people like Comey. Why go to all those lengths if there wasn't anything to be found by the investigation? You don't actually believe that. And I'm just trying to appeal to people to be reasonable. You may have other things you'd rather focus on, or there may be partisan reasons why you don't want to talk about this if you're Republican, but just try to be reasonable. Nobody acts that way.
Right, exactly. And also, you know, there might be other issues that you want to talk about, but you can do both. You know, you can pay attention to what's going on with this Russia probe, with possible obstruction of justice by our president, in addition to talking about what's happening with policy and all that. Now, the one thing that I thought was also incredibly interesting about his testimony is the reaction that Comey had after Trump had asked him to make the investigation go away, right? Or that he hoped that it would go away. Apparently, Comey testifies that he had no reaction. He didn't change his facial expression. He didn't say anything. He didn't make any gesture. He just stood there and stared at him, and they just stared at one another in awkward silence. Mm-hmm. And I can't even imagine how incredibly uncomfortable that would be. Well, that's a good point.
That's totally unnecessary, but sorry.
Yeah, right. So, and that was when Comey apparently felt uncomfortable enough to start writing down in memos the types of interactions he was having with Trump.
Yeah, and look, one of the talking points that you're going to hear is, if he thought that what Trump was doing was so inappropriate, why didn't he do anything at the time? They've been saying that. Republicans have been going on MSNBC and CNN to say that. But the counterpoint is obvious. Comey understands that this is likely not a solitary thing, that this means something and theoretically could matter in the future. Now, he could raise a big stink and get fired immediately. That's an option he could have taken. It doesn't seem particularly useful, but he could have done it. Or instead, he could continue to document, as he did, as Anna described, immediately what was going on and continue to build a case. That's what he did, and that's why we have as much information as we do. If at that first dinner back in January he had simply said, "Peace, I'm out," we would know far less than we do. So thankfully, Comey did not do that. Again, another one of the talking points is why was Comey hesitant to say to the public that Trump wasn't under investigation, if at that time, counterintelligence I should say, if he wasn't under investigation, which seems reasonable.
Right.
But as Comey described there, and I think a lot of people might have missed it, if he did that, and then the facts on the ground changed, and later he was the target of some sort of investigation, there would be an obligation, a duty on him to make sure that both Trump and the public understood that things changed. So if he wasn't under investigation and later was under investigation, he would have to go public and reveal that, which is not something that he wants to do outside of a few weeks before the election.
The sense that I get from Comey's testimony and also Comey's actions during the campaigns and even after the campaigns with everything that's happening with Trump is that he is obsessed with doing his job appropriately, right? And responsibly. And in that quest to do his job with as much integrity as possible, sometimes he makes moves that look really, really bad for optics or negative, right? Mm-hmm. And so, look, I don't have beef over what Comey did during the election, even though the timing was a little weird, and even though it seemed as though there was a little more focus on one candidate versus the other. But the sense that I get from his testimony and the way he handles things and the way he comes up with his conclusions and actions is he wants to do the right thing. And every once in a while, it seems like he overanalyzes things to the point where he missteps. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's just my take on it.
Yeah, well, no, I think it's interesting because part of this, I guess, at some point comes down to a he said, he said. Like,
right.
Who do you trust? Do you trust Comey or do you trust Donald Trump? And that doesn't seem particularly complicated to figure out for me, but I'm sure he still has some backers. I hear up to one out of three independents around the country still back him. So some people trust him, I guess. But Comey returned over and over to this idea that Trump could theoretically be lying and that Comey believes that he has frequently lied. And so let's jump into this montage showing just a sampling of the times that this theme came up during today's testimony.
The administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI, by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple. I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting, and so I thought it really important to document.
The president said, in one case I called him, and in one case he called me. Is that an accurate statement?
No.
The president was asked whether he had urged you to shut down the investigation into Michael Flynn. The president responded, quote, no, no. Next question. Is that an accurate statement?
I don't believe it is.
And again, that is not all the instances in which he either implied or said that Trump had been lying.
And by the way, the word liar or lying is very rarely used in politics, right? I think because lying indicates that there was intent. Mm-hmm. There was bad intent, that individual knew what the truth was and intentionally went out there and put out lies, right? Deceived individuals. And so it's just interesting to see Comey use that word and use it with no problem whatsoever. That said something to me.
Yeah, now the White House has responded to that. Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, I can definitively say the president is not a liar. I swear to God, if you watch the video of her saying that, she laughs a little bit in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. There's various ways you could explain that, but I think it's funny. She goes on to say, I think it is frankly insulting that question would be asked about whether he is a liar. Now, like we all understand, we've been around for the primary, we've been around for the general election. There's a dude that lies unnecessarily. He lies habitually. We all get that at this point. But I think in this case, it is going to hurt him because even the people who don't like Comey, I don't think that they think he went before the Senate and just lied and lied and lied to them. And he's given these accounts, you know, 7 pages of testimony was released yesterday. And he gives accounts of meetings, of phone calls. And Trump is implying that Comey is lying. But Trump is not giving an account of those instances. He's not saying what he said or how Comey might have misinterpreted it. So all we have is Comey's incredibly detailed description of what happened, including which doors he entered by, who was in the room at the time, who was asked to leave, and then silence from Trump, a man who doesn't appear to me to be hesitant to defend himself if he has grounds to do so.
And also another thing that everyone should kind of keep in mind with this story and, you know, the response by the Trump administration in regard to Comey's testimony is that they are going to latch on to any, what I would argue, irrelevant component of his testimony to mischaracterize him and also delegitimize what he's saying. Mm-hmm. Delegitimize him as a person. So one example would be the fact that Comey himself was the one who leaked the memo to his friend or colleague, and then that was leaked to the media. And so the Trump administration is latching onto that and essentially minimizing his testimony because he leaked something, mm-hmm. right? He's a bad guy because he leaked something. But yeah, the story here isn't whether or not Comey's a good person and whether or not it was a good idea for him to leak something. And by the way, Comey testified that he did do that leak because he knew that Trump was going to go out there and lie about him and what was going on in the FBI. But the real story here is, what did Trump ask Comey to do? What did he mean when he asked Comey to make the investigation go away, or that he hoped that the investigation would go away? That's the story. Don't let anyone from the Trump administration distract you from what's really going on.
Yeah, and that's a theme they come back to all the time, that it's not about the information, it's about the leaker. But while that's a weak defense normally, it's nothing now. I mean, that was a memo that James Comey wrote himself. He's allowed to leak it if he wants to. And by the way, you'd already fired him at that point. He's right. A private citizen, and it's a note he wrote. My diary is my business. If I want to give it to someone, I can do it. I don't even know why he leaked it to his friend who then leaked it to the media. That's just DC BS. Just give it to the media, man. If that's where you want it to end up, you can do that. So that defense by the White House doesn't make any sense
at all. Do like millennials do and just post it on Facebook.
Seriously,
have it go viral.
Just have it in the background of your Instagram story or something. Someone will catch it. Anyway, let's turn to another bit of this. Comey also made clear why he felt that getting to the bottom of Russian interference in the 2016 election was so important. Here is a portion of his remarks.
It's not a Republican thing or a Democratic thing. It really is an American thing. They're going to come for whatever party they choose to try and work on behalf of. And they're not devoted to either, in my experience. They're just about their own advantage, and they will be back.
There was more to it, though. I want to read a little bit. He says, this is a big deal. People need to recognize it. It's not about Republicans or Democrats. They're coming after America, which I hope we all love equally. They want to undermine our credibility in the face of the world. They think that this great experiment of ours is a threat to them. So they're going to try to run it down and dirty it up as much as possible.
And just to clarify, he's specifically talking about Russia.
Yes, and that is, I mean, if you look at almost any serious analyst of Russian foreign policy, that's basically what they believe. Not that they just think this great experiment of ours is a threat to them, but at its best, what it's intended to be, democracy, is a threat to people like Vladimir Putin, who don't want any of that. They don't want any of those freedoms of the press or assembly or religion or any of that. It is a threat, and that's why they attempt to damage it by messing with elections if possible, or at the very least cause people to question whether democracy works, to try to show to Russians, like, look, they don't actually like it, they don't trust their politicians, they don't believe that elections matter. Then there will be less of a call inside of Russia for democracy. Not sure that strategy is actually working out considering the massive protests that have been going on in Russia so far this year, but that is the belief. He also went on to say that in terms of his certainty that Russia was involved in some way, he said there's no fuzz on that and this is as unfake as it gets. And
he was very explicit in stating that Russia did in fact try to meddle with the election.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. It was the strongest statement in regard to Russia's involvement that I've heard so far.
Yeah.
From an actual official who's close to the investigation.
Who looked at the actual raw evidence.
And right.
I'm glad that he also broke it down, because a lot of people talk about this issue in incredibly vague terms. They say Russia and the election, or they say Russia hacked the election. Those are phrases that could mean anything or nothing. They could be used in whatever way you want, but he was specific. I mean, we're talking about not just all the paid bot farms and stuff like that. We're not just talking about what the NSA revealed to The Intercept, where they broke into that US voting software company and then broke into over 100 local election officials. I mean, he described hundreds or possibly 1,000 of intrusions. And we also know that the multiple hacks that went on. A lot of people try to simplify it as talking about the Podesta emails, the people who want Seth Rich to be the answer to all their concerns. But it wasn't just the Podesta emails, the DCCC was hacked into as well. Another Democratic campaign organization was hacked into. The RNC was hacked into as well. Unless you believe that Seth Rich had access to all of that information, then clearly there was more to it. People try to simplify it because they want to write off the entire thing. But James Comey, of course, understands it at a far deeper level. Anyway, there was one other bit of this where I want to give Kamala Harris some credit. Yesterday, while grilling the four intelligence chiefs, Kamala Harris tried to nail them down on a very important topic, and that is the special counsel investigating the possible obstruction of justice and all of that. Would this actually be an independent investigation, or will people like Rosenstein, who you're going to see in the upcoming video, be able to influence it or meddle in it? So she tried yesterday. Let's watch that.
It is that you would put in writing an indication based on your authority as the acting attorney general that he has full independence in regards to the investigations that are before him. Are you willing or are you not willing to give him the authority to be fully independent of your ability statutorily and legally to fire him?
Yes
or no, sir?
He has the full independence as authorized by those regulations.
Are you willing to do as has been done before?
Would the senator suspend? The chair is going to exercise its right to allow the witnesses to answer the question, and the committee is on notice to provide the witnesses the courtesy, which has not been extended all the way across, extend the courtesy for questions to get answered.
Mr. Chairman, respectfully,
Mr. Rosenstein,
I would point out that this witness has joked with
the senator
ability to filibuster.
Mr. Rosenstein, would you like to thoroughly answer the question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, I'm not joking.
So if you watched yesterday with those four individuals, you know that dude, he loves to filibuster.
Yeah.
He will just spin you in circles.
In fact, he did filibuster after the exchange that you just saw. And then Harris's time ran out and he didn't answer the question.
Yeah, exactly.
And so she knew exactly what he was going to do, which is why she was calling him out. And of course, she got talked down to by a member of the GOP.
Yeah, I think I'm sure that a lot of women are probably familiar with the sort of interaction you saw there. Like, no, people question the witnesses. They interrupt if they start to filibuster. It doesn't always generate that sort of response from the chairman. It seems to for some reason in this case, oddly enough. But yeah, for whatever reason, we've decided we're going to give those senators 5 to 7 minutes to question on an incredibly important topic to question these people. And so people like Rosenstein know that if they simply dance around the topic, they can waste a significant chunk of that time. She was trying to not allow that to happen. And she is, after all, the senator. Rosenstein is there to answer their questions. He was trying to avoid doing so. So she didn't get an answer from him, but she did bring up the topic with Comey today, and you'll see that in this clip.
Do you believe he should have full independence?
Oh yeah. And he wouldn't be part of it if he wasn't going to get full independence.
Thank you.
So there, he should get it. Unfortunately, we don't know if he will get it because that's Comey, who's no longer in power. But she did send out a set of tweets. So if we could bring up that first one there, it shows that she's not going to back off the topic. Yeah, she said, key point, Comey told Rosenstein about his concerns about Trump meetings, which was described by Comey today. Then Rosenstein still wrote the memo justifying his firing. And Rosenstein's memo has been shown to be 100% lies, by the way. Rosenstein now oversees a special investigation run by Mueller, which is something we should be concerned about. Yesterday, if you can go on to the next one actually. Today, Comey affirmed under oath that Mueller should have full independence. But again, that isn't, at the end of the day, the answer that she or we want. And it's still possible that Rosenstein or whoever ends up being his superior could interfere. It's also entirely possible that Trump could simply fire Robert Mueller if he wants to. That is not impossible. It would look questionable, but I got news for you. Firing Comey looked questionable.
Yeah,
he didn't hesitate to do that.
It doesn't seem like he really minds whether or not something looks questionable. I don't think he even really thinks about ramifications before he takes action. I wonder if he was shocked that there was backlash after Comey's firing. He might have been, who knows?
He said that he was, or it was leaked that he was, but who the hell knows?
Right, who knows, exactly. But yeah. Look, I want to be fair, and Comey's answer wasn't just that one sentence where he should be independent or have independence. He also said he wouldn't be part of this unless he has that independence. And I don't know how Comey knows that, and I don't
know. Well, I'm sure he's talking to him.
Right, so I just.
Look, Mueller can believe or want whatever he wants. Certainly he's a smart man, he knows this process, but he is not in control of the actions.
That's true.
The head of the FBI or Trump.
So I don't know what's really going on behind the scenes. At this point, look, this is an incredibly uncomfortable story to even comment on because a lot of it is based on interpretation of specific wording, interpretation of what someone means, and they could mean something completely different. There's a lot of vague language being thrown around. So with that, I just want to make sure the audience is aware. There is a lot of speculation going on, and I don't want anyone to think like everything is clear cut, cut and dry. That's not the case. So
people want certainty.
They want
certainty,
but everything involving the story is incredibly uncertain.
That's true. That's true.
I just want to be open and honest about that.
Okay. Well, so this had uncertainty. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we've got the exit polls from the UK's election. A lot of uncertainty there since they're exit polls, they're not the final returns. But we will break those down when we come back from this break. We will also have a very positive move in Kansas in regard to their tax policy after this. Welcome back to the Young Turks, everybody. Lots to get to, but we do want to read some of the tweets from you. And also my concern that I expressed to Anna that I believed that she had shared a dog video on Facebook during the last segment. It turned out you didn't.
No.
When I saw that, I was like, man, she's a master of her phone. I didn't even see her take it out.
I started uploading a really cute video of Charlie to a close Facebook group. And it was processing when we went on air, and then it finished processing while we were still on air. So it appeared that I put. Anyway, I don't need to explain myself. Okay, you guys saw me. I immersed myself in the show.
Yeah, most of the time when we go to a one shot of me, it's so that she is free to upload videos of dogs. Anyway, okay, some tweets for you. Brian Nguyen says, "Silence from Donald Trump today. I wish hashtag Comey hearings were a daily affair." I'm not gonna give credit to him because as I said, no one will be less fair to Donald Trump than me. But whoever it is that stopped him from tweeting, they did an amazing job. He really didn't say anything. Horrendous sons did talk, but.
It's not 4 a.m. yet though.
That's true, right. That's true. Oh, he's gonna wake up and he's gonna be on a tear. That's probably true actually. I Am Sock says, while the Comey testimony is gratifying, it's also one of the worst points in American history. It's pretty bad. We've done some worse stuff, I think. But it's also exactly what a lot of people thought the Trump presidency would be like. Yeah, he's gonna make massive mistakes, he's going to commit crimes, and we're gonna have these sorts of hearings. So that happens. Tom Zawaki says, when your boss says, I hope we can finish this by the end of the day, you usually take it to mean get this shit done, which is true. And I love that Julia Mahoney says, in light of Comey being fired, I think the quote, I hope you can make this disappear, came with the implied quote, before I make you disappear.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true. That is true.
Yeah.
I would give her a t-shirt, but I'm fairly certain I don't have that authority. Anyway, and people have been tweeting me, by the way, about the TYT pin that I wore a couple of days ago. It's apparently not for sale yet, but many different pins will be for sale soon. So keep your eyes on the store. Anyway, with that, let's turn back to the news. Britain just had their big election. Now, originally they weren't supposed to have another election until 2020, but Theresa May, head of the Conservative Party, decided, you know what? I have got this stuff locked down. I'm gonna have an election now and get a bigger majority, making it way easier to rule for the next few years and easing the way into the negotiations for Brexit to be conducted in the fashion that I want. Oops. She might have made a massive miscalculation, combined with other miscalculations. Like there's a huge issues that people have in the UK with a change to the health policy that means that people who have at home care, if they pass a certain threshold, they'll have to pay. There's legitimate reasons that the party is less popular than it was. But we have election day today. We don't have the final results, but we do have the exit polls. So let's bring those up. And you're gonna see a comparison between the current breakdown before the election on the right, with the Conservatives having a very narrow majority at 330 seats when you need 326. And then on the left, you have the exit polls. Now, these exit polls are almost certain to be off at least a little. They might be off enough that the Conservatives will maintain a majority. But as of right now, we have ourselves a hung parliament. That's what it looks like. And now it gets into complicated territory that few Americans should talk about with any certainty. But I have done some research, and there's a variety of different ways that this could play out. The final numbers are gonna be incredibly important for this, because theoretically, she can get a couple of the very small parties that are at least more likely allies for the Conservative Party, and together they can reach 326. That's certainly possible, but not for certain. It also could be possible that she gets booted out as the head of the Conservative Party. They get someone else. They continue on as a minority party until new elections are called for later on in this year. That's also possible. Thank God in America, by the way, that we can't have elections like after 4 months. Mm-hmm. It'd be disaster.
Yes, it would.
But that's what's going on right now. We're still waiting for the final numbers, and that is, after all, what's really important. But it appears that Theresa May have massively miscalculated in holding these elections. And it could be significant, not just for her or for the Conservative Party, but for how the Brexit negotiations are gonna go on. Like, this could be history changing here, that she decided to make this play when she did. Anyway, with that, why don't we jump back into some domestic news. We'll give you an update tomorrow on what ends up happening with Britain. Maybe we can get a British correspondent to chime in on that. But we're gonna jump back to America. After years of suffering, Kansas's tax problems might finally go away, at least in part, after Republicans this week overrode their own party's governor's veto of a tax increasing bill. So basically what happened was years back in like 2014, Brownback comes in, Republican governor, and he decides, you know what? We have these fantasies as a party of massive tax cuts, and you know what? I'm gonna go all in. And so he slashed taxes for individuals, for corporations, massively changing their tax code. And the idea was, the defense at that time, was that this is gonna stimulate so much economic activity that you don't even have to worry about the loss of revenue. It is going to fix itself. Now, progressives like us have been telling you, and people have been telling you for decades, that that's not actually how it works. And so they had their experiment in Kansas, and we saw the results. I actually went to Kansas a year or two ago with a union of teachers on the 50th anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education, because their education system has been devastated by the lost revenue. Their transportation system, road maintenance, all of that devastated because they're not making the money that they used to. Not only are they getting less tax revenue, but there are so many loopholes that many individuals are reclassifying their income as small businesses, and it has been a disaster for Kansas. Credit to the Republicans, at least in some part, they've been trying to fix this now for a few months, trying to pass at least small increases in taxes, repealing some of those tax cuts. But Brownback has stopped them. until this week when they were able to get a veto-proof majority. And so now, I mean, we're not talking about a lot of taxes, by the way. We're talking about very small numbers. Individual income would be taxed at rates of 3.1%, 5.25%, and 5.7% starting in tax year 2018. The changes also end Brownback's tax cut for certain business owners known as the LLC exemption. That is the progenitor of many of the loophole problems that they had.
Yeah, look, I know that those percentages don't seem like much, but they do have a very large impact in terms of raising revenue for the state. So I do want to give state lawmakers, particularly right-wing state lawmakers, a great deal of credit for doing what they're doing, for fighting on this issue, even after the governor vetoed it. I love the fact that they got together and they found a way to override his veto. And essentially, they did the right thing. They realized that it was hurting their state, it was hurting their constituents. And I love that for once, politics were pushed aside, and regardless of political ideology, these lawmakers decided to represent their constituents as opposed to big businesses.
Yeah.
With that said, though, there are similar problems in other states, including blue states like California. Mm-hmm. So in the late 1970s, and this is different because it's not a governor coming in and changing things up, but in the late 1970s, California passed a ballot measure known as Prop 13. And that dramatically cut tax revenue to the state in the form of property taxes. It capped property taxes at, I believe, a little over 1%, 1.5% of the value of a home, right? And so think about it. Education is funded through property taxes. And so the LAUSD, for instance, was one of the best school districts in the country. And then after this ballot measure passed, the school suffered because they lost a bunch of revenue. And the other part of that ballot measure was that in order to increase taxes, you needed a two-thirds majority to vote in favor of increasing taxes, which never happened.
Which is incredibly tough.
And so California suffers in a similar way, even though the tax cuts were done in a different method or through a different method. And so anyway, I'm giving you all of that because this is a problem that we're seeing throughout the country. I like that Kansas is taking a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and that this is not the tax plan that I would have passed in Kansas, obviously, but this is Kansas after all, and you'd have a better chance of electing a captain from ISIS than a Democrat there. So the Republicans are going to have their say. And so, yes, it was the Republican fault that they had this problem in the first place, both the governor and the state legislature, but at least they, to some extent, fixed it. Now, this is consequential not just for Kansas, but for the US as well. If there's any reason in the world, if people are rational at all, it will matter, because this isn't just sort of theoretically like the Republican tax plan, like Trump's tax plan that he wants to enact across the entire country. Many of the people who crafted Brownback's plan are economic advisors for Donald Trump. So they are trying to do to the country what they did to Kansas. What Kansas suffered under for years, and what they had to, under emergency conditions, fix. So we can theoretically get in front of that in the US. We don't need to allow them to pass that tax plan and cut corporate taxes down to a third of what they are now. We don't need to decimate the federal Department of Education, departments of transportation, health, and all of that. We don't need to go down that road. We can learn ahead of time from Kansas's example and make sure that it doesn't happen in the first place. This should be a learning experience, not just for Kansas, but for all of us.
Right. I mean, I feel like, you know, federal policy in regard to taxes should have served as a case study for why cutting taxes doesn't make sense, right? I mean, did it stimulate the economy when we cut taxes for the wealthiest, when we created corporate tax loopholes that essentially allowed the biggest corporations in the country to not pay a single dollar in income taxes? Mm-hmm. I mean,
I'll have to check.
I mean, we know what the answer is. And so I'm not in, you know, agreement with anyone who thinks taxes need to be insanely high for people who earn the most money. But if you're a millionaire or a billionaire, paying your fair share of taxes will still allow you to remain a millionaire or a billionaire. You're going to be fine.
Yeah.
So.
One final thing, Brownback, obviously the bad guy in this, but he's even worse than you might think based on just this issue. So Brownback vetoed a bill that raised more than $1 billion in tax revenue back in February. So that was the prior attempt to fix the situation. And then followed that by striking down the legislature's attempt to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act a few weeks later. Attempts to override the governor's veto on both those bills failed. So again, Medicaid, a program that theoretically helped some of the most vulnerable Kansans. The Republicans tried to do at least something approaching the right thing there. But no, they've got Brown back, and so it didn't actually happen. So
I mean, and honestly,
too bad for Kansas.
At this point, it's up to the constituents of Kansas to make the right choice when, mm-hmm. you know, in future elections. Brownback is not looking out for you. It's very clear.
Yeah.
And so if even the GOP lawmakers in that state are butting heads with him, there's something up.
You would think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we are going to have to take our second break. So tweet us at hashtag TYT Live what you think about those two stories. What do you think the outcome will be in the UK? If you're from the UK and you actually know something about this, feel free to educate us, or at least me. And when we come back, we're going to have the House voting on Dodd-Frank. It's bad news. We're going to break down why here. And then attempts by the Trump administration to reauthorize, perhaps permanently, an incredibly controversial section of FISA. We'll break down the implications of that when we come back from this break. Welcome to what remains of the first hour of the Young Turks. Cenk's still out. He didn't come back during the break. So I'm still John. That's still Anna. And we've still got some tweets to read, actually. Charles W. says, are you sure fresh elections are a bad idea after 4 months? A parliamentary system would look good to the US now. Well, that might be true. I mean, under our current system, we already have elections every 2 years, and the campaign season runs for about 18 months. So we only have like a brief respite as it is.
I don't have, maybe this is a statement that'll get me in trouble, but I don't care. I don't have faith in the electorate to make the right decision now.
Right now?
No, I do not have the faith.
He's less popular.
Doesn't matter. I think they'd still somehow miraculously elect him.
Well, Republican turnout is better in midterm elections, unfortunately. That's one of those inconvenient truths people are going to have to remember as we get towards that 2018 election. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons I have hope, but not boundless amounts of it. Let's see, Ben Sorrells responded to the Kansas story saying, funny, conservatives say tax breaks work. One look at Kansas says otherwise. Maybe Kansas should look at Minnesota for guidance. He didn't say where he's from, but I think I know. But yeah, there are certainly states that are doing things in a much more intelligent fashion, and their people are benefiting. Because at the end of the day, it's not just like the Kansas's government didn't have money. Like, that has consequences. The people whose, the kids whose class sizes absolutely blew up because of the lack of funding for their education system, like, they now go out, they go to high school, they go to college. Like, that detriment never goes away. Like, they're hurt for the rest of their lives.
Yes.
Because of this terrible decision that Kansas Republicans made to cut taxes.
I feel like our education system does fail us in some ways. And one of the things that I wish there was more emphasis on is just how our system of government works and why people get taxed. And what, you know, what components of government or of our society are socialist and what parts are privatized and why, right? Like, I feel like education, at least grade school education, doesn't delve into that enough. And so a lot of people who are tricked by right-wing propaganda to vote against their best interests and to vote for tax cuts for the wealthy are just completely unaware of how much they will be affected. And yeah. I'm not trying to belittle them at all. I just think that it's just a failure of education, of the type of dialogue that we should have in the country. I think they're just completely unaware of how much they're going to get hurt by these taxes.
You've done multiple stories about the textbook manufacturers.
Yes, that's right.
They're not generally in Massachusetts.
They're in Texas, right?
Yeah.
And so if the manufacturers are in Texas and the state school board in Texas gets to decide what type of material is in those books, well, it's going to have a negative impact on pretty much every student in the country. So.
Yeah, and lib teachers are always terrified of somebody saying they're being partisan in the classroom and losing their job, understandably, because people do lose their jobs. So sometimes they think it's easier just to avoid that sort of stuff or to go very subtle on it, and that can be lost on kids, unfortunately. But let's talk about let's talk about making history, actually. We've been talking about history. Today we're going to talk about history in our own country. Today, House Republicans voted to destroy the vast majority of the limited regulations and protections that were set up for oversight on Wall Street after the Great Recession. Yes, that's right. They voted to basically shred Dodd-Frank. It was a warning that I made before the election that this was likely to happen. It did happen. They voted it down today. So in case you're not familiar with the Great Recession, blessedly, It cost tens of millions of jobs to the US economy, many of which never returned. And it also cost the government trillions of dollars conservatively in bank bailouts. The long-term effects, by the way, have been estimated to be anywhere between one and something like $27 trillion in lost economic output and all of that. I don't know exactly what the number is, but it's bad. And they decided to move us one step back closer to the possibility of another recession just like that by removing the little bit of extra protections that we got after the Great Recession. So let's talk about what this bill does. First though, Paul Ryan is so thrilled that they were able to do that. He said, "We see the Financial Choice Act as the crown jewel of this effort to foster economic growth. The Dodd-Frank Act has had a lot of bad consequences for our economy, but most of all in the small communities across our country, small rural communities that are the headquarters of Bank of America and Goldman Sachs, for instance." So yeah, he tweeted about it too, just constantly. This is about small business, this is about jobs on Main Street. No, this is about easing regulations on some of the biggest corporations in the history of our planet and making it easier for them to make the same sorts of risky decisions that they made that led to the Great Recession. But of course, they're gonna frame it a little bit differently. Let's break down some of the things the bill did. Hensarling is the Republican who initially sponsored it. His bill would give the president the power to fire the heads of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an organization the Republicans have never been in favor of, and the Federal Housing Finance Agency, which oversees mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, at any time for any or no reason.
That sounds like big government to me, right?
It does seem like it.
It sounds like you're giving the president a lot more power.
Yeah.
Isn't that big government?
It does seem like it, yeah. And those organizations are supposed to be less political. They're supposed to be slightly more independent. That's one of the reasons the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been able to accomplish the things that it has, you know, back when it, you know, had funding and a leader and all
it's
that.
It's called the Consumer Protection Bureau.
Yeah, that's what
they
don't like.
It's called the Consumer Protection Bureau.
Yeah.
And they hate it.
They've hated it since before it existed.
Right.
Elizabeth Warren amongst that. It also gives Congress purview over the CFPB's budget. That is, again, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's budget, meaning lawmakers could defund the agency entirely. So it could still exist, but its leader can be removed at the drop of a hat and they could have a budget of $0 theoretically. But that's not all. The GOP proposal would also bar the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation from overseeing the so-called living will process, which requires banks to write up plans on how they would safely be unwound in the event of a collapse.
Think about how important that is, by the way, right? For everyone, but and this was not a partisan issue. Both Democrats and Republicans were outraged at the bailouts, mm-hmm. right? And so doing away with what John just mentioned would essentially allow these banks to repeat what they did during the financial collapse of 2008 and get bailed out again, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're too big to fail. We're gonna lose too many jobs and it's gonna be terrible. They will be free to do what they did again without any ramifications, without any plan in place, without any forced plan in place mm-hmm. to unwind the damage that they've done to their own organizations or yeah. corporations. It's just disgusting.
Yeah, I think, look, there's even more we're gonna get to, but this is perhaps the section that is the clearest middle finger to regular people because they have problems with the regulations and all that. This is simply, we want you to be responsible and have a plan for theoretically, if things go as badly as they went before, how would we protect the system from being destroyed by you being destroyed? We just want you to have a plan in place. No, we don't want that anymore. Screw that. Full steam ahead to the next recession. Don't worry about any of that. Don't plan for any of that. The government's not gonna plan for it. The banks don't have to plan for it now.
So I want Paul Ryan to be specific about how Dodd-Frank has been bad for the economy. Mm-hmm. I want him to be specific because I could give you very specific reasons why Dodd-Frank has been good for the economy, mm-hmm. right? We haven't had another housing collapse since, right? And by the way, to be absolutely honest and clear with you guys, Dodd-Frank was an incredibly watered down regulatory bill, okay?
Yeah.
And so I'm not that impressed with Dodd-Frank to begin with. I would like to see it strengthened, not weakened. But how exactly-
But you want it.
But I want it, I want it. I want to build on it, much like the Affordable Care Act. I do not think it's perfect, but I do not want to get rid of it and have Republicans replace it with nonsense, which we will talk about an hour or two today, so you want to stick around for that. But this is madness, and it is a middle finger to Americans, right? It is a giveaway to corporations. I was listening to Bloomberg this morning, and they were talking about, you know, what the House just did with this vote. And there was a Wall Street guy being interviewed who was so happy about this. Mm. Is he a representative of the average American? No, this is a corporate guy.
Small businessman?
Not even close. I unfortunately didn't catch his name, but just hearing him talk about this, it's just the only people who will suffer from repealing Dodd-Frank are Americans who need this to protect them from corporate greed. And it's just so sad to see what the House is doing right now.
Yeah, the Republicans were elected. Trump was elected to represent the big banks. That's why his cabinet is full of Goldman Sachs representatives and the representatives of the other big banks. You said one thing that you wanted Paul Ryan to explain. I would love Paul Ryan. Getting rid of the living will process. I want you to show on camera the person on Main Street who gets a job because you took out the living will process. I would honestly love to see that. But that's not all. It also repeals the Volcker Rule, which means that the banks can go back to making the incredibly dangerous, risky, speculative trades that they were doing before, the huge gambles that have basically no upside for the individuals who pay into the bank. They only have an upside for the bankers who are using that bank and the people who put the money in, their money as some sort of crazy Las Vegas headquartered in New York. So that's gone, or that will be gone if the Senate goes along with this. Increases odds of more bailouts, obviously, and further weakens the SEC, because why would you want an investigative body that could look into the abuses the repeal of Dodd-Frank will produce? Of course you don't want that. You're gonna let them do more risky stuff, and then you're gonna weaken the cops who are supposed to be watching them while they do it. And so they really got pretty much everything they wanted out of this. Now, of course, it's gonna go to the Senate. Some people are like, why, John, on Twitter, why are you so worried about the repeal of Dodd-Frank? The Senate's dysfunctional. The Republicans don't like each other. Okay, it is entirely possible that the Senate won't go along with this. But if your whole defense is, I don't think Mitch McConnell can get it done and work with Donald Trump, that is we're in such a pathetic spot. That's not supposed to be our defense, okay? And understand, and by the way, that this passed on party lines, just for the record.
And I think that, you know, in the case of healthcare, you could use that defense. But when it comes to Dodd-Frank, I feel like the GOP has been rather united. They've been pretty united on the issue. They hate Dodd-Frank. They hate the Consumer Protection Bureau. And to be quite honest with you, in the Senate, Republicans can afford to lose 2 votes from Republicans and still manage to pass a repeal of Dodd-Frank. That's something that you should keep in mind. It's not something that you just brush off and think that it's not gonna happen, it's not gonna harm you. It could absolutely pass. And again, the GOP has been relatively united on this issue from the very beginning.
It's a preview for the debate over the tax plan, by the way. It's something that they've been ready to do on day one. But don't worry, we heard during the election that they wouldn't work together. So that will be our defense, I guess. Anyway, quickly, one other thing I want to get to in what's left of the first hour. A new bill in the Senate that has significant support, stated support from the Trump administration, could theoretically make permanent a controversial section of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that has good cause to be controversial. The bill would permanently reauthorize a section of FISA that permits the government to spy on Americans who are in contact with foreigners. The act is currently set to expire at the end of the year. So basically, this is a section where it says you can't spy under this on an American talking with an American. But if you are communicating in one of many different formats with someone living abroad, a foreign citizen, then they can suck that up. It could be phone calls, it could be emails, it could be text messages, it could be all sorts of things. And what's incredibly important about this is the government has defended a lot of surveillance in the past, saying it's just metadata. Why are you getting your panties in a wad over it? In this case, we're talking about the literal content of communications, which means that theoretically, in many cases without warrant, if you're talking on the phone with someone, if you're sending an email to someone living abroad, they can have the full content and details of that communications, and they could, under this bill, have it for the rest of time.
So I want to clarify, they would be able to do this without a warrant?
That is my understanding, yes.
Okay, so I have a massive problem with mass surveillance, right?
And this is according to the NSA, by the way, that it can be conducted warrantless.
Right, and first of all, I think mass surveillance is ineffective, and it makes more sense to hone in on conversations or exchanges with people who, you know, display some sort of probable cause or some sort of suspicious behavior. Which, of course, if you prove that there's some suspicious behavior, you can easily get a warrant from a judge and then have at it. Go ahead and spy on them, right? Yeah. But it's just such a waste of resources, and it's so ineffective to just be able to warrantlessly, I don't even know if that's, can you say that, warrantlessly?
I like it.
Okay, whatever. To, without a warrant, just spy in on someone's conversation simply because they're speaking to someone in a foreign country.
Yeah.
Right? Look, I always go back to the fact that we have given up some of our rights, you know, pertaining to the Fourth Amendment, right? We have willingly allowed the TSA to search us in every way imaginable. We have made excuses for the NSA and other intelligence organizations for spying in on us and all that, because in the name of national security. But now more than ever, you know, you hear the same fear-mongering from politicians. You hear the same arguments that we're under siege and, oh my God, there's an imminent threat of radical Islamic terrorism in the country. So how much more do we have to give up for them to actually effectively do their jobs and stop fear-mongering? Yeah. They're gonna continue fear-mongering because they want you to willingly give up your rights.
Yeah, and I think, like, some people, I guess, if you don't routinely conduct overseas communication, you might think, I guess that's more likely to be suspicious or threatening. But think about in practice how broad this actually is.
Yeah.
If someday, and I know it's not likely, but theoretically, if someday Emma Watson ever responds to one of my DMs, the NSA could read that. Trust me, they don't want to read those. Okay, but they could. That's how broad it is.
Yeah.
Like if you're studying abroad, or I traveled to Europe recently, if I was emailing back with TYT, I guess theoretically the NSA could have that information. This is incredibly broad. I want to read one quote.
I just want warrants involved. I want probable cause. I want some indication that there is a real legitimate reason to spy in on someone's conversation, yeah, right? And unfortunately, maybe the majority of Americans don't value that. I don't know. I don't know why there's, you know, no big controversy when stories like this come out. But if you genuinely value our Constitution, mm-hmm, it's not just about the Second Amendment or the First Amendment. It's about all of it, right? Yeah. And we have a right to privacy. And unless there is some, you know, reasonable suspicion and a warrant, I don't think it makes sense for the NSA to just spy in on that conversation.
Yeah, well, I think that this is an area where I have at least some hope. I understand that when we cover a lot of different topics on this show, and sometimes you slip a story like this in, and it can be overwhelming to people because every day there are new things to be worried about and new things to call your representative about and to march for. There's so many different things that you have to split your attention and your time and your passion and your energy to. But this is important. It might seem a bit ephemeral and vague, but these are fundamental rights that theoretically could be permanently taken away. Now it's gonna expire at the end of the year. And it's something that I think that people can make a difference on, because a few years back, you know, we had a national concern about how much privacy we'd given away in the wake of 9/11, and we got some things done. And a lot of those rights are still not ours again, but there was some progress. And I think that this is an issue that if people are organized on, and if people make clear that they care about it, if they communicate with their lawmakers, it's something that we can make progress on. Because this is an area where, theoretically, for a lot of congressmen, they're not making a bunch of money off this.
Right.
And so it's an area where theoretically their donors don't have as much to say, and so they can be moved on. It's important. I know it's another thing to put on you, but hopefully people will fight this to make sure that this reauthorization doesn't happen. Anyway, that is the end of the first hour. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
Always good to do a first hour with you.
Thank you.
You're going to be taking over after this break.
Yes, Grace Baldridge will join us for the second hour. And there's a good mix of policy stories in there, along with some more non-political fun stories that I know we'll have a good time with. So stick around, you want to see that, including a breakdown of what we know so far about the Senate's version of Obamacare's replacement.
Okay, look forward to that. We'll be back after this break.